This is a reading of Riddle of Life, originally published in the September 1969 issue of Sat Sandesh. This is the English version of one of Master Kirpal Singh's satsang talks, originally given in Hindi at Sawan Ashram, Delhi, India. Live to learn and learn to live is an age-old adage. No man is an island unto himself, or can shut himself in an ivory tower for any length of time. Each one of us contrives a world of one's own according to his mental makeup. The human mind works in diverse ways. It is an ever-active instrument. At times it recalls the past, however distant, from the depth of the unconscious. This is the work of the mnemonic mind, technically called chit. The unconscious is a great reservoir or storehouse of all the impressions that one gathers in one's lifetime and carries with him from life to life. Some of these impressions keep filtering through the subconscious and appear on the surface of the conscious with or without any effort on the part of an individual. These are the recollections, whether recalled or automatic, as the case may be. As these pop up in one's head from the unknown to the known, one begins to dwell on them. This dwelling process, or the association with the past events, incidents, and experiences, is called manan, or the thinking faculty of the mind. As one takes into consideration the pros and cons of the matter, he begins to reason out and enters into what is called ratiocination, the reasoning faculty of the mind, intellect, or buddhi. The individual understanding of the wisdom involved gives one a sense of personality called ego, or ahankar. As we grow from experience to experience, we willy-nilly weave a connected chain of cause and effect, running endlessly from life to life in spite of us. We cannot possibly live without being influenced by or influencing others. But nobody can give out more than what he has received or acquired. Even nature itself cannot give more than what it receives from us. One cannot overreach himself and give what is beyond his own reach. The world, therefore, is but a reflection of one's mind, an image or a shadow without any substance in it. Once I had an opportunity to attend a seminar on the Gita. This memorable sermon, like other scriptures, is full of esoteric teachings, which a layman cannot understand so easily on the level of the intellect, unless explained by an awakened soul, well-versed both with the theory and practice of paravidya, the knowledge of the beyond. One who has an actual experience of self-realization and God-realization can explain lucidly things which otherwise baffle human understanding. All the scriptures sing the glory of such an individual master soul or guru who can give an actual demonstration of what he says as evam Brahma. Here is Brahma. In the Gita itself, chapters 4 through 6, an emphasis is laid on finding a man of realization before one can know of the God path. It is he who can explain what it is, who actually puts one on the path, and can safely and successfully lead the aspirant to the goal. The Gita, for example, tells us that the God way starts from a point between and behind the eyes. So far, so good. Now, where exactly that point lies, and how one can reach it and penetrate through it, is something that cannot be explained and done away with. It is a subject of practical significance. For the spirit is to be led to it so as to have a peep inside. We cannot do this with all our learning and wisdom when, for ages upon ages, we have become accustomed to flow externally into the world of senses. It is a subject that is abstract and abstruse and requires tapping within. The word images simply convey the sense but cannot give the actual experience. During the course of the discussion, a pundit, a learned person in scriptural lore, came to the pulpit and asked the audience to get ready for the God vision that he was going to present. By his sound logic and learning, he kept the audience spellbound. But beyond giving a word picture, however beautiful it might have sounded, he could not actually give a demonstration of reality. Learning, as you know, is nothing but inferential knowledge. It appeals only to human feelings and emotions. All said and done, we end by saying, where there is nothing, there is God. As the great Irish dramatist W.B. Yeats puts it, or as we read in the scriptures, God is wondrously wonderful. Both these statements are correct as far as they go, but neither gives us a first-hand experience of, nor brings us any the nearer to God. Thus we see that one cannot take us further than where he himself reached. An intellectual giant is as much within the range of his senses and mind as any of us. One who has not crossed the mental zone cannot possibly take us out of that. We have no doubt to start with reading, writing, and thinking. This is just an elementary step. The sacred books are our greatest treasure. We need them. We can read them, but may not understand them fully. They do contain gems of spiritual value, but we are not equipped to evaluate them properly and reach into their true import. On the other hand, it is the man of experience and realization who is competent to explain what is contained therein, for he speaks from actual experience of his own, similar in broad lines to those ancient writers who traversed the path in days gone by. It is therefore said, "Listen ye to the true testimony of saints. They speak what they actually perceive within themselves." It is perception alone that inspires a person. An inspired song is much more than mere poetry, for it has an essence of his very being in it. Hence it is said, "It is an inward eye that makes one sing. Such a song brings in its own reward." We do feel that God is all-pervading. Yes, it is so. But a feeling full reference alone does not convey the real truth. It is just a blind man's statement. We know the anecdote of four blind men who wanted to know what an elephant was. One who felt the animal's leg thought of him as a pillar. The other, whose hand fell upon his ear, considered him like an outstretched fan. The third, with his hand on the abdomen, thought of him as a big barrel. The fourth, who grasped the trunk of the elephant, took him for a baton. Thus, each of them made a mess of the elephant, because none of them had seen the animal. As their statements were based on individual feelings, they failed to describe what the animal was actually like. This is how errors creep in when we hear the account of God from those who have not experienced the Spirit and power of God. Each one talks from his limited knowledge, and thus we get conflicting views of God knowledge. A man of realization, on the other hand, knows how to reconcile these apparent contradictions, which are just on the surface, because of each person's limited knowledge. The basic truth being the same, an awakened soul goes to the root of the matter, explaining the various inconsistencies rising out of individual limitations. Herein lies the great hiatus between the statements based on feelings and emotions and those arising from actual perception. Let us consider the matter from another angle. God is one. He works differently on different levels. To some, he appears as Brahman, the creator. To others, as sustainer. He assumes the form of Vishnu. And to those who look upon his destructive power, he is symbolized Shiva. Thus we see the society split into different sects, each at war with the other. The position may be likened to a great powerhouse generating electricity. It is the same power which at one place works as a heating apparatus, and at another is used in the manufacture of huge blocks of ice. One who is not conversant with the alpha and omega of electricity cannot possibly understand the opposing functions that the same power performs. The real nature of a thing is hidden in the thing itself, like fire in wood, butter in milk, or scent in a rose. We are dealing with the mystery of life. We want to know what life is and how it enlivens the material masks we have put on. What is the source from whence life springs, and how does it work on different levels of existence on the earth plane? We are all living on the plane of senses and are experiencing life with the help of sense organs and the mind. All these instruments are limited in their nature and do not give us a correct answer to our problems of life. True knowledge is an essence of the soul and is independent of the mind and senses. Unless we are able to get a mind-out-of-body experience, we cannot have a first-hand experience of the life impulse working in and around us in its fullness. This is why we find in the Vedas, truth is one, but sages have described it variously. The moment we try to grasp truth, it eludes, and we are left with nothing but mere words to describe reality. In Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it is said that to bring God within the ambit of the intellect is as difficult as to quench thirst by liquor or to get fat or tallow out of sand. A saint has put it beautifully, one cannot comprehend him through reason, even if one reasoned for ages. Spirituality is not a subject of thinking mind, nor of reasoning intellect. Reasoning is both a help and a bar. Reasoning, as said before, brings us to a negative plane when we begin to think of reality as neti, neti. It is not this, not this. What then is it? For this we have no positive answer, and there cannot be any answer at all in any language whatsoever. It can be answered only by a tongueless tongue or a speechless speech. It is an unwritten law and an unspoken language to be known by the soul in a flight of the alone to the alone. How to have this sublime vision of the invisible? It is possible only when the senses are subdued, the mind is at rest, and the intellect too is stabilized. In other words, it is an out-of-body experience. This is something rare. A perfect being can give us a right understanding and a right insight. Without this basic righteousness, there is no way out. All surface differences vanish into airy nothings when we get inner perception. We have before us the problem of Grihast Tyag, life of a householder versus a renunciate. Some believe that God can be sought and practiced by a householder, while others maintain that a life in the wilderness is a sine qua non for God realization. But the truth is that neither of these two states is of any avail without right understanding and insight. In this connection, the scriptures tell us, one cannot come by happiness either in one's home or in quitting the home. Real happiness is a state of the mind and does not depend upon one's environments. Where then is it to be found? We have to condition our mind into a state that leads to happiness. So it is said, happiness lies in correct thinking and the right lead which the saints give. Saints, it may be understood, are born and not made. They perceive God with an inward eye and are in conscious contact with the Spirit and power of God. They speak from actual inner experience and not from the level of the intellect. They do not hesitate to call a spade a spade. When they know reality directly and immediately, they explain that simply. On the other hand, a person well-versed in book knowledge depends only on what is stated in the books and has nothing to offer anything from within himself. His account is all hearsay and secondary. The truth of the matter is that there is some creator who has created the universe, and we call him and worship him by so many words, Ram, Allah, God, and the like. These are mere names that we have given to that power. That power is one and only one, no matter what and how we may call it. To get out of this rigmarole of nomenclature, the ancients began to adore him as Adoration to Thee, O Thou, the Nameless. This, then, is the correct attitude. It is the Nameless who is to be worshipped, and worshipped in spirit. The devotees of the Nameless and the Impersonal began to personify the spirit and power of God by giving him names based on the various attributes of that power. This was quite an easy approach to God power. The all-pervading came to be known as Ram. The source of all creation was proclaimed as Vishvambar or Bishambar. As an all-absorbing power, he came to be known as Krishna. This is how the various cults came into being, and social formations sprang up. There is nothing wrong in these social groupings, the object of each being to take persons from the line of least resistance to the pinnacle of godly glory of the Nameless. But unfortunately, we are caught in the social web and find ourselves as tightly bound to cults and creeds of our own making, forgetting the one reality. Myriads come to the firing range to hit the bullseye. Religions may be different, and yet all aim at the same reality. Thus we see that the aim and object of all the cults and creeds are to lead man from the personal to the impersonal. But whether they succeed or not is a different thing. Spirituality, however, is not bound with religious groupings or occupational pursuits. Ravidas, a cobbler, had as much a right to spirituality as Kabir, the weaver, Namdev, the calico printer, or Tulsi Sahib, a Brahmin. The social divisions are all man-made. So are our social religions. God made man after his own fashion, and man, in his search for God, tried to personify God and to monopolize him. The Brahmins were the first to lay claim to Brahma Vidya, or the divine knowledge that would not be imparted to other classes. Thus came into existence different social orders on an artificial basis, with formations degenerating into stagnation, and stagnation in turn resulting in deterioration. Now you can see for yourself what man has made of man. The embodied soul has come to identify itself with body alone. The human body, made as the veritable temple of God, is now a temple without God. Are not we all children of the same God? We are all fashioned in the same way, both internally and externally. We have been provided with a wonderful house to live in, and this house is subject to disease and decay as any other material thing. We are being driven outward through the senses into the fields of sense enjoyments. This is the greatest ailment and is common to all of us. Seeing, we see but do not perceive. With all our learning and knowledge, we are ignorant of reality. As we have not developed inner vision, we see things through colored glasses of the mind. This is the crux of the problem. With blinkers on either side, we do not see anything except what comes under our very nose. This is called individual thinking, apart from cosmic thought that takes into account the divine plan governing the whole universe. We have therefore to pause and ponder as to where we are going. Are we on the right path? If not, how are we to turn aright? The social orders do not come in our way. They too have their own purpose. The society, too, is to be run on sound lines. This is the ethical side of the problem, but this is not all. Within us, there is the inner man, the soul or spirit. We have to attend to the needs of the spirit as well. Man does not live by bread alone. We look well after our physical and intellectual needs, but what of the spirit? We never had an occasion to look inward, nor have time to do so. This is the most important part of our being, and yet we ignore it the most. For this, we will have to rise above body consciousness, so as to become self-conscious. Self-realization is the first thing and the last in our development. Swamiji has explained this beautifully. If ye wish to rise above the world, ye shall have to follow the footsteps of the saints. Saints know the intrinsic worth of the world, but we do not. I placed this simple proposition in my talks in the West. Truth is not so difficult as some of us have made it, and most of us have come to believe it so. All this is because of the lack of practical experience on the part of our preachers. Preaching has unfortunately become a profession, a paid profession. We presume and assume many things of which we have no real knowledge. A blind man cannot lead the blind. All their fiery speeches have not a spark of real fire in them. They speak on the level of the mind and intellect, without any real knowledge and first-hand experience of truth, with the result that they start beating about the bush. Instead of making reality easily intelligible, they make it more difficult to understand. In their enthusiasm, they begin to interpret the text in so many different ways. Bookish knowledge is all wilderness, unless one has known and experienced the hidden truth which the sacred books pronounce. The divine wisdom as contained in the scriptures is called Guptbani, or the exposition of the hidden truths, to which their writers had an inner access. About this unspoken language, or Guptbani, it is said, "The word of the wordless has been giving out truth through all the four ages." This, then, is the grand truth which we have to understand and practice in our daily life. Who can initiate us into the mysteries of the Holy Word? None but a Word-personified saint. The Word is the only truth, or Sat, while all else in the world is a mere shadow of the Word. And shadow without the substance has no reality in it. We have therefore to contact truth. This contact with truth is called satsang. Who is to give us this contact? As said above, it is possible to get to it through the instrumentality of one who himself is one with truth. Sat Sarup, Word made flesh. This is real satsang. This is the end of part one, continued on part two.